All right, well, thank you all for coming back after lunch. Like my colleague listed here, Sarah Carlson, I generally only speak to farmer audiences anymore, so it's a lot of fun to be here today to talk about some long-term research that farmers in Iowa have been conducting over the last several years. I'd like to first acknowledge all of the people and organizations that have played a part in this long-term research. I'm from Practical Farmers of Iowa, but we're also working with Iowa Learning Farms. They were instrumental in recruiting the sites and the farmers. Of course, the farmers that have been involved over the course of the study, and then our funders as well. So a little bit, I know Sarah, if you were here earlier today, went over a little bit about who Practical Farmers is. We're a nonprofit organization headquartered in Ames, Iowa. We have close to 3,000 members. We are entirely member-led and member-focused. Our farmers are our doers. They host our field days, and they conduct our research, and you can see that depicted in these photos here. And you can see our mission there about farmer-led investigation and information sharing. So just real quick, how does Practical Farmers do this? Well, we do it in two primary ways, one of which is field days that our farmers host and show to other farmers around the state all the neat things that they're doing, the research they've done, and things they've found out. This last year, 2015, we held 40 field days across the state of Iowa. Now, we do also have livestock and horticulture farmers, so those aren't all field crop field days, and I don't go to all of those, but we do hold several field days every year. And then more where I come in is the on-farm research project. That's my role with the organization as the Cooperators Program Manager. You can see this map here. That's all our research, on-farm research sites for 2015 that have finished or are ongoing, and then all our on-farm research reports are publicly available on our research or on our website, and I've listed the URL there. And as a result of the programming and the research our farmers have done, our members have reported on the stewardship, profitability, and efficiency that they've improved on their farms as a result of all the things that we've done. So that's really exciting. It's really fun to work with these kinds of farmers that are curious. And primarily how we go about conducting research on farm, on a commercial farm scale, are paired strip trials, right? So usually just two treatments. The width of the strip is the size of a combine or some implement, and the length is the length of the field. So the farmers are our doers, right? I can help them design an experiment, help them come up with their question, design an experiment that then teaches them how to answer that question properly. And then they go out and put this in themselves. Right, so really, really simple, or easy enough for them to do, so not like five or six treatments on small plot scale. So moving more into cover crops and the importance of cover crops, folks in the upper Midwest are probably familiar with this subject. Water quality, it's not really nothing new in the state of Iowa, but it's been elevated in the news quite a bit over the last year because the Des Moines Water Works, which serves over 500,000 people, is suing three drainage districts in three counties northwest of them that they are claiming are dumping nutrient pollution into the river that then is affecting the water quality for those customers. So in the 9 years or so that I've been in the state, this is the most that we've ever been talking about water quality in the state, even though it's really not much of a new problem. And you know, the state came out a year before this lawsuit with the nutrient reduction strategy, which was basically a good collection of all the science that's been done on protecting water quality from ag lands and presenting it in a full compendium. And a number of practices are listed in that strategy for farmers and landowners to draw from to then put on their land to improve water quality. And so when I'm just going to take a look at the infield practices for nitrogen, and you know, we can look at nitrogen timing application and sources and stuff like that. But we get to the bottom and we see that as far as infield management, cover crops show the best promise. But of course, right next to that, the studies that they drew from to make these conclusions, we see this change in corn yield. And that's where farmers really, really, really get anxious. They say, well, yeah, water quality is great, holding the soil in place is great, but if that affects my corn yields negatively, there's no way I'm going to be doing that. So that's why working with farmers who already kind of had an ethic of soil conservation and nutrient retention is really enjoyable because, you know, they were starting to look at cover crops before it was cool, looks like, in 2008, right? So now it's all in the news, but these guys started looking at it quite a number of years ago, and so now we're starting to be able to build up data and answer some of these questions that have only mostly been answered on a field plot scale at university research stations. So farmers want to know, okay, that works there, but how does it work on my farm on a larger scale? I'm in different parts of the state from where that research took place. So this is a look at one of our research sites. You can see these alternating strips of cover and no cover. This is right before termination in the spring. And here is a map of the locations where the research took place as part of this trial. And you can see it's all across the state. It began in fall 2008, and over the course of the time since then, 12 farmers have participated, and now there are only 7 remaining. Some people dropped out mostly because they didn't want to do the strips anymore. They just wanted to cover their entire fields with cover crops because they were convinced. So some of them we had to tell, no, please leave some empty strips. We'd like to keep doing this research. And they said, okay, we'll do it. And so here's a look at how the 6 farmers that were in corn in 2014 managed their fields. We let them manage them however they wanted to, however they saw fit for their location. Right, so that in terms of how they were going to seed the cover crop. And the cover crop was the same across sites. It was cereal rye, I should say that. They could drill it. They could aerially seed it. They could choose the seeding rate, whatever they thought was appropriate for them, then however they wanted to terminate it. And then they planted corn or soybeans after they terminated it in the spring. And then, again, this is just a look at the 6 farmers who were in corn in 2014. Right, so now looking at corn yield data across the length of the experiment. On the x-axis are the locations and the years. You'll notice that there aren't 12 or 6 farmers every year listed under there, and that's just the reality of on-farm research. Sometimes they're in a hurry to get things done, and those strips get bulk harvested. Right? That's just the nature of the beast when you're working on commercial farms. But those strips were maintained, so next year if they were able to do it, you know, we'll be able to look at those effects. I'll also just point you to, we also always like to just kind of focus on the negatives to begin with. These are the instances where the stars and cross are where the cover crop had a negative effect on corn yield. And the farmers who operated at these farms, they told us that, well, you know, I just didn't get correct termination with the herbicide, or my planter wasn't set properly. And also it should be noted that this is in the first 2 years of the study, okay? The next few years, 11, 12, 13, 14, there were no reductions or no changes in corn yield between the cover or no cover. In 2014, most of those farmers saw yields over 200 bushels per acre, regardless of if there was a cover or not a cover. So I like to sum up the corn yields like this in these big pie charts to kind of show the early phase of the experiment versus the later phase. Okay, so in 3 site years early on, we saw yield decline, but then after that, the farmers figured it out. We didn't all jump on a bike right away and know how to ride a bike. You know, there's a little bit of a learning curve, at least in corn. So when we changed over to the soybean side, again, not everybody was able to report every year. That's just the nature of the beast. And we see that actually earlier on, these stars represent where there were yield improvements with the cover crop. And so one of the farmers, George, he's at Kelowna. We were at his farm earlier this year. He actually told me that he thought that the soybeans liked that high amount of residue and a little bit of that competition early in the year, and that got the soybeans going. Now, that's just him speculating, but he's been doing this for a few years now, and he thinks that the soybeans kind of like that early competition from the rye cover crop that's deteriorating after it's being terminated. So the story with soybean yields, there's maybe a little bit less of a learning curve that our farmers have found when they're using a cereal rye cover crop ahead of a soybean crop, because early on in the kind of beginning stages of this experiment, we already saw some yield improvements. As we went on, it looks like there's more yield maintenance. There was one instance of yield reduction, not sure exactly why that happened. It was 2013 that was really wet early and then got really hot and dry late, but that was only, again, in one instance. We like to sometimes just focus on these like one negatives, but overwhelming trend is that there's mostly maintenance and there's not a negative effect of the cover crop. And I will say that the yields for this year, 2015, are just starting to roll in. I wasn't able to put those into this presentation in time. I know of a soybean farmer who one guy who was in soybean this year, and yields were improved by 4 or 5 bushels with the cover crop. And one of the gentlemen who was in corn, they were even, and they were just about 200, 205 bushels per acre. So again, it doesn't look like, at least for the few that have reported this year, wasn't so much of a negative effect of the cover crop like a lot of farmers are worried about when they think about cover crops in corn and soybean systems. So the conversation about cover crops for a number of these farmers that have been using it for a number of years is starting to evolve, right? So we're starting to see maybe there's not so much of an effect on yield, but what else might be going on? And the notion of soil health, and that's been a theme of a lot of different talks that I've been to at the conference over the last few days. So we started to think about, well, these sites have been in cover crops for 5-6 years. Let's start pulling some soil samples and see if we can gauge any differences or tease out any information about the soil microbial community. And so we used the Solvita portion of the Haney test, which is a novel soil test that I'm sure a number of you have heard about, that is now trying to gauge soil health and maybe even make some nutrient recommendations, fertilizer recommendations for the grower. But we just wanted to look at the soil health component, and particularly the Solvita burst, which is basically gauging respiration of soil microbes. Okay, so we went out this June and pulled cores in all the strips, 6 inches deep, and you can see quite a wide variation across the sites. Two sites were in corn and the other 5 were in soybeans, and there was no significant difference between cover and no cover strips. Right, so these were in the standing crops after the cover had been terminated and the cash crop had been planted. But there is quite a bit of disparity between the sites. Some of these farmers have been in no-till for over 20 years, and some of them told me that they didn't expect me to find any differences because it's been such good health, good soil for over 25 years since they went to no-till. And the numbers seem to bear that out, that at least we can tell that over 5-6 years of just a cereal rye cover crop in corn soy systems, that there was no difference in soil health or really soil microbial activity. Now, we do read about that in other journal articles, and so why we didn't see that here might be regional differences, the species of cover crops used, or maybe 5 to 6 years of using cover crops in a corn soybean. Only a corn soy rotation isn't going to really have much of an effect on soil health. But what really makes this kind of work enjoyable is how the farmers react and what they tell me after doing this for so long and what it means to them and then what it means to those around them. So I've pulled a couple of quotes from some of the farmers involved about why they like doing on-farm research and what it means to them and how then they talk to their neighbors and their friends about what they found out. So that's really, the cream on the top of this. And just to go over some of the conclusions again, for the most part, 42 out of 46 site years, there was no negative effect or no change in the yield. So that kind of disputes some of the things that farmers are worried about. In the most cases, we're not seeing any effect on yields. And we are seeing soybean yields increasing in some instances, and we haven't really found any effect of the cover crop on soil health in any of these strips. So there's my contact information and where you can find more of our research reports. We don't just do it on cover crops. We do research on all kinds of things, crop rotation, stuff like that. I also have a poster out in the poster session, number 501. It's out there today. I'll be there 4 to 6 if you want to come talk more about this, or I'll take any questions now.
Thank you. So we have time for maybe one quick question.
Yes, sir.
So if I'm a farmer and growing cover crops doesn't impact my yield, and it costs money to put cover crops in, why do I do it?
That's a very good question. So some know that it's holding their soil in place for extra generations, holding nutrients in place, but that is the next question. How can we move from a negative impact or neutral impact to an improvement? And I get that question every time I give this talk to a group of farmers, and I don't have a very good one, to be honest. All I can say is that this is what the farmers have found, and most of them are doing it, or at least they tell me, because they think or they know it's the right thing for soil and water, right? And they already have that ethic, and they're trying to convince their neighbors and their friends. But it's a very good question, and it comes down to that all the time.
Please, for my session, 1:30.
Oh, yeah, so Tim will be able to talk about that
All right,
in a kind of session.
All right, thank you.